I've been trying to put together things that would sort of stand on their own and have done the same for today. Today I want to talk about a couple of the sort of policy proposals in response to the question, what do you do? Or what ought we to do about world hunger? These are discussions of especially the role of the United States and aid for the very poor countries. I'm going to be talking about two things. The technical terms are triage and lifeboat ethics. I'll explain those as I go. I think you'll recognize that all kinds of people talk this way, whether they know about those terms or not. If you have conversations, you soon get around to what is in fact the substance of triage and lifeboat ethics. First, triage, that comes from a policy that was used in the Allied medical tents. The word comes from a policy that was used in the Allied medical tents during World War I in ordering the treatment in priorities in the treatment of the wounded. Three groups were designated among the wounded. Those that were likely to die regardless of what was done were separated from those that were likely to live even without treatment, at least immediate treatment. And those in turn were a different group from the third group, those who would survive only if attended immediately. With limited personnel and medical supplies, only that third group, those likely to survive if attended immediately, were treated. That policy was known as triage, meaning it's from the French word triere, meaning to sort, to separate. All it amounts to is the simple determination of who it is that will receive limited critical resources when the demands of the time or when human extremity exceeds the supply of those critical resources. A recent House Committee on Agriculture subcommittee report of October of last year asked this question: will you and I as American citizens someday have to participate in the choice of food triage, similar to that facing combat surgeon in war? That subcommittee's report didn't linger very long before it was addressed. And Time magazine's special report on the world food crisis of November, just a few weeks later, had this to say: in the West, there is increasing talk of triage. If the United States decides that the giant would simply go down the drain as a mere palliative because the recipient country was doing little to improve its food distribution or start a population control program, no help would be sent. This may be a brutal policy, but it is perhaps the only kind that can have any long-range impact. A triage approach could also demand political concessions. Washington may feel no obligation to help countries that consistently and strongly oppose it. As Earl Butz told Time, food is a weapon. It is now one of the principal tools in our negotiating kit. Incidentally, about a month ago, I was writing a case study on food policy, and I went to Capitol Hill and collected all of the proposed bills on the food program. There are 32 of them now, proposals for the change for the Food for Peace program, which is the U.S. foreign aid food program, and about a third of them are proposing what is in effect triage, food triage. So Time magazine is right. There is increasing talk of triage. It's not altogether new. In 1967, William and Paul Paddock co-authored a book that was for the most part kind of written off at the time. That book was entitled Famine 1975. The proposal in that volume is straightforward enough. Triage should be, said the Paddock brothers, the mode of U.S. food allocation in the coming era of widespread famine. response to that book at that time, and I remember it very well because it was discussed at the American Society of Christian Ethics meeting, response to the book ran along two lines. It said, first, for a variety of reasons, the projected food shortage and the famine would in all likelihood not occur. And secondly, even if it should, a government policy of selective starvation or selective survival, no matter which way you want to look at it, is unthinkable. And that book was kind of dismissed. There were, however, a few voices that continued to talk about the unthinkable. One of them, and the one that's caused the big stir, at least in the literature lately, is that of Gerhard Hardin's. And now I'm going to read to you what I think are enough of the paragraphs from an essay called Lifeboat Ethics, The Case Against Helping the Poor. Enough paragraphs to give you the flavor. This, incidentally, has also been the subject of great debate on Capitol Hill. Gerhard Hardin has testified before at least a half dozen of the committees in Congress advocating lifeboat ethics, which is another way of talking about triage, case against helping the poor. And there's been response to the essay. It was printed in the Congressional Record, and a number of senators, Hatfield, Clark, McGovern, have all recorded their replies to it. Okay, some paragraphs from Hardin's essay on what he thinks ought to be done with respect to food, energy, and population. If we divide the world crudely into rich nations and poor nations, two-thirds of them are desperately poor, and only one-third comparatively rich, with the United States the wealthiest of all. Metaphorically, each rich nation can be seen as a lifeboat full of comparatively rich people. In the ocean outside each lifeboat swim the poor of the world, who would like to get in or at least to share some of the wealth. What should the lifeboat passengers do? First, we must recognize the limited capacity of any lifeboat. For example, a nation's land has a limited capacity to support a population, and as the current energy crisis has shown us, in some ways we've already exceeded the carrying capacity of our land. So here we sit, say 50 people in our lifeboat. To be generous, let us assume that it has room for 10 more, making a total capacity of 60. Suppose the 50 of us in the lifeboat see 100 others swimming in the water outside, begging for admission to our boat or for handouts. We have several options. We may be tempted to try to live by the Christian ideal of being our brother's keeper, or by the Marxist ideal of to each according to his needs. Since the needs of all in the water are the same, and since they can all be seen as our brothers, we could take them all into our boat, making a total of 150 in a boat designed for 60. The boat swamps, everyone drowns, complete justice, complete catastrophe. Since the boat has an unused excess capacity of 10 more passengers, we could admit just 10 more to it. But which 10 do we let in? How do we choose? Do we pick the best 10, the neediest 10, first come, first served? And what do we say to the 90 we exclude? If we do let an extra 10 into our lifeboat, we will have lost our safety factor, an engineering principle of critical importance. For example, if you don't leave room for excess capacity as a safety factor in our country's agriculture, a new plant disease or a bad change in the weather could have disastrous consequences. Suppose we decide to preserve our safety factor and admit no more to the lifeboat. Our survival is then possible, although we shall have to be constantly on guard against boarding parties. While this last solution clearly offers the only means of our survival, it is morally abhorrent to many people. Some say they feel guilty about their good luck, being in the lifeboat. My reply is simple. Get out and yield your place to others. This may solve the problem of the guilt-ridden person's conscience, but it does not change the ethics of the lifeboat. The needy person to whom the guilt-ridden person yields his place will not himself feel guilty about his good luck. If he did, he would not climb aboard. the net result of conscience-stricken people giving up their unjustly held seats is the elimination of that sort of conscience from the lifeboat. This is the basic metaphor within which we must work out our solutions. And then the essay concludes, last paragraph. Without a true government to control reproduction and the use of available resources, the sharing ethic of the spaceship is impossible. Incidentally, Hardin was was one of the people that really made that image of spaceship Earth, a widespread one. Now he says, conditions have worsened since the time he wrote that essay, The Voyage of the Spaceship Earth, so we must take up the lifeboat one. Without a true government to control reproduction and the use of available resources, the sharing ethic of the spaceship is impossible. For the foreseeable future, our survival demands that we govern our actions by the ethics of the lifeboat, harsh though they may be. Posterity will be satisfied with nothing less. This is a serious kind of proposal. Food triage, then, and lifeboat ethics, how should Americans respond? Or if you want to stay with Hardin's metaphor, what should the passengers on a rich lifeboat do? I just want to run through what are the responses to food triage and energy triage and lifeboat ethics, just some of them that have already been registered. The first response, which comes especially from those who are keeping watch over world conditions, systems analysis, Club of Rome, Limits to Growth, Mankind at the Turning Point, Ford Foundation kinds of assessments, people who are keeping track of world conditions, their response is to say that the world conditions are such now that there will be very strong pressures to attach an ethics of triage to an ethics of affluence. That is, that the rich will have very strong pressures to move toward an ethics of triage. The reasoning, in very highly encapsulated form, goes like this. We are rapidly encroaching upon limits to growth. There are natural limits, economic limits, social limits, technological limits. These varied limits to growth will probably be the most threatening, not to the poor nations, but to the well-off industrialized nations. It is the rich nations that live off of a flow of materials and energies from the whole world. Thus, these people say, our affluent patterns of living are dependent upon, in an indispensable way, upon the not so rich, upon the other rich as well, and upon the poor. That is to say, it is necessary to the kind of living that we're accustomed to that there be a certain set of trade patterns, certain relationships between rich and poor countries. As the severe stresses that arise from encroaching limits to growth increase, the strongest drives, these people say, on the part of the rich nations will be in the direction of so organizing the world so as to protect our accustomed, rather high, standard of living. We will do what we can to maintain that affluence. With dwindling resources and other obstacles that are associated with limits to growth on the one hand, and with increasing demands on the part of the poorer nations to have a part of those resources, on the other hand, the ethics of affluence will work out in operative policy as the ethics of triage. That is, we will say, we will not be a part of keeping alive all kinds of people who probably won't make it anyway. That will be one way to take cut down the pressures upon limited goods and resources. Now, this first response says, still, this doesn't need to be so. Triage conditions and triage ethics can both be kept at bay. And the Club of Rome is saying this. But the requirement for doing that is some rapid, dramatic, far-reaching effect that, in point of fact, changes the lifestyle of the well-off. It means a transformation of persons and structures that mean, in the end, means an end to the age of affluence. A lot of people are already talking about that. We're moving from a time of affluence to scarcity, scarcity as an enduring condition for the foreseeable future. If triage conditions are to be avoided, these people say, the future just can't be what it used to be, so to speak. All right. It's at this point of advocating dramatic changes in world structures and in lifestyle changes for the rich, the literature takes an interesting turn, and all that sort of dry prose of the engineers and the economists turns into moral exhortation. That's an interesting case in itself. Let me just read you a paragraph from Mankind at the Turning Point, a book that's in the bookstore. As we propose the implementation of a program which our world computer model suggests is feasible and desirable, we take certain things for granted. We assume, or at least hope, that our lifestyles will change, that we, the consumers, will understand that our frivolous use of energy takes food from the mouths of children. We assume that no one who knows the situation will continue to call economic growth a system that gives us more and more material goods while people elsewhere starve. Those of us who live in the developed world have, we are told, the highest standard of living the world has ever known. That assertion is made in reference to the material goods we possess. But if we knowingly consume less energy, if we deliberately own fewer goods, if we consciously simplify our lives just a little, so that others may have only the minimal goods and food to be alive, then what really will happen to our standard of living? Won't the standard, the moral standard, really rise? I picked this up as a kind of typical example. You go through graphs and pages of computer printouts and interpretations of that, and then they're at this point of the consequences of what they see as the world conditions, and incidentally, a lot of that is very debatable, as Paul Hain will be glad to tell you. But at this point, the language turns to rather passionate moral exhortation. Well, in other words, this first response to triage and lifeboat ethics then sees something like this. It envisages the conditions of triage as eminently possible, but not yet present. It judges the well-off in the world to be tempted in the extreme to attach an ethics of triage to an ethics of affluence. And yet it says neither triage conditions nor triage ethics are necessary if we can manage a kind of basic redistribution of wealth and power by way of global structural changes and lifestyle changes, if we can do that and do that soon enough. A second response, and these responses aren't just set beside each other as parallel, they don't always address the same thing. A second response is also preoccupied with the future, but it restricts its speculation about triage to triage as a deliberately chosen policy. Let me say what I mean. Some people are saying that triage will in fact come about as an actual operating policy. And a few people are saying that it already is. But, they say, it will not be a policy that anybody, or meaning Congress or public at large, explicitly debates and selects. Like many of our important policies, it will simply be the evolutionary outcome of thousands and thousands of small choices made everywhere, from import quotas to household shopping lists, and the outcome of those thousands and thousands of choices on the part of the citizens will be, in effect, an operating policy of triage. None of those decisions, those choices, ever asks head-on, now who shall be fed, and who shall not be fed, or in stark language of triage, who shall survive and who shall not survive. These people are saying triage will be our policy, yes, but it'll emerge in a very quiet and unfocused way. This is the outcome of a multitude of very thinkable, very reasonable, very understandable decisions, like one's diet for one's family. It will add up to, in Hannah Arendt's phrase, and she was talking about something a little bit different, talking about exercise of kind of tyrannical bureaucracies, it will add up to rule by no one, the banal accumulative evil of small decisions made everywhere. Now, I said some people claim, and one hears this again in the testimony before congressional committees, some claim that we are already practicing triage in the U.S. food policies. When the president had approved food for Syria but did not approve it for Bangladesh and India, these people saying if we would be relentlessly honest about the consequences of that, we would see that that has something to do with the death of lots of Bangladesh and Indians. And so these people are concluding that triage is already our mode of dispensing food. Okay, there's a third category of response to triage, and it challenges the use of this analogy at all. It says something like this: sufficient food exists or can be produced. The world food crisis, as I said a couple of days ago, is not a production and supply crisis, it's a price and distribution crisis. There's food enough. It's simply grossly mislocated. So ours are not the conditions for this sort of desperate division of peoples and nations into the three groups of triage. There's, in fact, one must be extremely suspicious of anybody, especially the well-off, talking about triage. These people say the well-off talking about triage affects a kind of self-serving self-deception, where people actually find consolation in a description of things that allows them to employ the hard ethics of supposed necessity, the hard ethics of triage. The line goes something like this: times are tragic, we can't do anything about this, nature will simply have to take its course. This line of reasoning, say these people, is maybe perfectly sincere, but it's also ludicrous because it makes recourse to triage in a world of plenty. That's like saying there are enough medical supplies and personnel to treat all three groups of the wounded, and still you choose only to treat one. That's not the hard ethics of necessity, but something else. All right, and these people say that there's another sort of misanalogy or misappropriate use of triage, and I think at this point there's no doubt they're right. Food triage speaks of nations in the way that medical triage speaks of the wounded. And yet it's not nations that are dying, it's people. Enormous tragedy can occur, and an India or a Bangladesh or a Tanzania can go on as a nation, experiencing great upheaval, resorting to harsh measures of all kinds domestically, turning to the politics of desperation internationally. In the wartime triage, the medical triage model, the wounded are by definition the incapacitated, the impotent. In the food triage model, that analogy doesn't fit because the aid, or the refusal of the aid, is directed toward the nation as the agent. And it's not the nation that's dying. The nation goes on as a throbbing and often an explosive force in the international system. In other words, writing off, as the proposal is, for some of the pending legislation, writing off certain nations like India or Bangladesh is not, as those triage discussions seem to assume, to be finished with those nations. Millions of people die, but politics lives on. There's something I think very, very, very important in that. All right, let me just sort of chalk up these three kinds of responses to triage and turn to some of the responses explicitly directed to Hardin and the people who advocate, other people who advocate lifeboat ethics. A very important article appeared in the February issue of Harper's Magazine by Francis Moore, Lape, the dietitian, and now someone who's spent an extreme a lot of time on world hunger. That article is entitled Fantasies of Famine. I'll just read you two paragraphs. In the first line, she's quoting Kennedy, so these aren't her own, Senator Kennedy, these aren't her own words. After decades of surplus food, it comes as something of a shock to find that we too face acute scarcities in available resources. So says Edward Kennedy in all sincerity. Hearing a statement like this, you or I might be tempted to indulge in the almost pious feeling that, ah well, in the face of the earth's finite limits, rich and poor alike sail humbly in the same boat. In one sense we might, but spaceship Earth is, after all, just like any other big ship, divided into three classes, rich, not so rich, and the poor. And when a ship begins to go under, the third class passengers don't share a common fate with the first class passengers. When the Titanic sank, 56% of the third class women passengers drowned, while only 4 of the 143 first class women passengers lost their lives. The well-to-do rarely, if ever, share the fate of the poor. Most commonly, they determine it. The pious feeling that we are all facing scarcity helps us hide from ourselves the fact that we are actually helping to create scarcity. Seeing famine spread through Asia and Africa, many would now believe that our development efforts have failed, that it is time to shelve our Judeo-Christian ethics in favor of the ethics of last resort, lifeboat ethics. Development has not failed, it has simply never been tried. The first maxim of nautical ethics is that you don't go to the lifeboats, which will only save a few, until you've made every effort to salvage the ship for the sake of all. I'll just record that as one response and then move on to another and get through these so we have some time for discussion. Daniel Callahan, who directs an institute called the Institute for Ethics and Society, the Life Sciences and Society, wrote a response to Hardin. Callahan finds Hardin's argument, and I quote Callahan now, powerful, troubling, and as one living in a rich country, immensely seductive. Its power, Callahan says, lies in underlining a seemingly inexorable trend, a rapidly growing world population so far under no control or real limitation, situated within a human community that seems to have neither the will nor the skill to do much about the food problem. Hardin's additional appeal is to our responsibility to future generations, and that touches another nerve. Is it not desirable, Hardin asks, that at least some of the grandchildren of people now living should have a decent place in which to live? It is hard to answer no to that question, particularly when the sum is implicitly taken to mean the grandchildren of those on the rich lifeboat, that is, my grandchildren. Callahan then goes on to register several objections to the arguments of lifeboat ethics. And the one that I really want to underscore is an apparent assumption on the part of Hardin's, namely that our lifeboat is a self-sufficient vessel. That's hardly the case. If you examine the trade patterns, especially since World War II, as well as more recent energy politics, you can see that. And that's hardly the case. If you examine the trade patterns, especially since World War II, as well as more recent energy politics, you can see that. An interdependence exists, and it is one with a flow of goods and materials in the world that favors the wealthier nations. In other words, an interdependence exists among the nations whereby the underdeveloped have greatly aided the development of the overdeveloped, and continue to do so. But Hardin's lifeboat, populated by the rich, doesn't reflect this reality. The reality, that is, of the necessity to the rich of the not-so-rich and the poor. In fact, what I'm trying to say is that the lifeboat of the rich is not a self-sufficient vessel. In fact, the lifeboat of the image of a lifeboat at sea cannot, as an image, adequately portray the existing relationship of those in the boat to those on the outside and their interdependence, their need for one another. It's a deceptive metaphor. This deceptive metaphor of the lifeboat image, Callahan goes on, easily fosters a self-fulfilling prophecy. Because when you start thinking lifeboat, you immediately think not all can be saved. Therefore, any talk of rescue assumes, when you use that metaphor, that language, that symbol, the rescue of only a few. But on a planet whose carrying capacity we simply do not really know, that assumption issues in action or non-action that goes on to fulfill the predictions of catastrophe. That is to say, if no one attempts to aid the desperate en masse, then their cause clearly does become hopeless. Their fate then surely is sealed, even if it wasn't so before. So Callahan's point is that the lifeboat image, just thinking that way, using that metaphor, issues in a self-fulfilling prophecy whereby those that are not, you do not try to save all, and then that, as a consequence, you do not. Now, for the comparatively well-off, what Callahan means by the immensely seductive nature of lifeboat ethics and triage as well, argument rests in its ability to combine several appealing elements in the same argument. There is the appeal to us of what you might call no-nonsense realism. No-nonsense realism means something like this. Times are tragic, life is tough, and for the eventual good of all, some drastic action must now be taken, regrettably harsh though it may have to be. The lure here, Callahan says, is a subtle one. It's the enduring attraction of hard-nosed decisions that might get rid of once and for all that long list of nagging human problems that doesn't have any lasting resolution short of final solution. Another way of saying that is that the hungry and the poor and the starving present endless difficulty to us if somehow they survive. They don't present any difficulty to us if they don't. There's that appeal kind of no-nonsense realism. There's lots of problems that are solved by the most drastic solution rather than something short of that. There's also the appeal in the argument to our self-interest. And in fact, it's self-interest cast in the strongest possible terms, namely those of survival. So, the thing that I was reminded of in reading Hardin's essay, at least especially in the part where he talks about a world food bank and how that's a non-solution. The thing I was reminded of was a scenario that some of you may remember from the 1950s. It goes something like this. If your neighbors were trying to break into your bomb shelter and there weren't enough goods available for all for the foreseeable future, what would you do? So the appeal there is to self-interest in the terms of survival itself. There is the further, in Callahan's words, positively irresistible appeal that resides in, again quoting, the possibility of both doing well and doing good. Now what does he mean? Hardin's case, and I'm using Hardin for shorthand for all kinds of people, the case made by lifeboat ethics is that it is in fact in the long-term interest of all, both our long-term interest as the comparatively well-off and the long-term interest of the future generations, both the future generations of now poor nations and the future generations of relatively well-off nations. Thus, Hardin argues, taking the lifeboat ethic in tow is doing good. It is on behalf of future generations. As he said, posterity will be satisfied with nothing less. At the same time, it allows us to continue in our affluence. So we are doing well by it. Now, any argument that can affect that kind of combination, where one can both act prosperously and at the same time be doing something which is eminently moral, is a positively irresistible argument. There's one more thing that I would just add to Callahan's list and in his article. It's the attraction of any ethics that is cast in terms of brute necessity. That is, any time you can define a situation as so desperate, any time you can define a situation as desperate in the extreme, then you put morality on a new basis. That allows you to do things which are otherwise unthinkable. Case in point, one of the more bizarre ones but true, was that case of the cannibalism, in quotation marks, of the Andean survivors. What was it, a couple of years ago, 3 years ago or so? I remember reading the response of Richard McCormick, who's a highly regarded Roman Catholic ethicist. And McCormick's response was, no moral problem involved in that, because the situation was one of utter necessity, of complete desperation, so that they ought not even to have bad conscience. There may be all sorts of traumatic psychological effects, but morally, there isn't any problem. What I'm saying is that the lifeboat ethics and triage have the appeal of defining things in terms which allow the ethics of brute necessity. That permits one to do all sorts of things that are regarded as drastic measures in good conscience. All right. These four appeals of lifeboat ethics can play upon one another in a way that gives them cumulative force. If you just think of these things in turn, and again, I'm only trying to register what I think I hear people talking about in maybe different language, but the same substance. If survival ethics can at the same time be seen as embodying high moral purpose, the welfare of future generations, at the same time as that be viewed simultaneously as necessity, if we can both do well by it, that is, maintain our prosperity, as well as do good, I don't know what could be more compelling as an argument for passengers of a rich lifeboat. Well, there's one more matter that Callahan has to say. A warning on another issue. He says lifeboat ethics is to be repelled because it will take a very heavy, though unseen, toll on its practitioners and their children, and not simply a heavy toll on those outside the lifeboat. Callahan says, if we are to worry about our duty to posterity, as Hardin says we should, it would not hurt to ask what kind of moral legacy we should bequeath. One in which we won our own survival at the cost of outright cruelty and callousness would be tawdry and vile. You can put the matter in somewhat more pointed form and ask, what happens to a people who are, at the same time that they reside in plenty, making decisions as to who shall and who shall not survive? Lifeboat ethics, Callahan is saying, might well be the death of their moral sensitivities. Lifeboat ethics might, in other words, mean a kind of brutalization of the human spirit, sort of joining moral cynicism, nothing can be done, with a certain kind of hedonism, sort of eat, drink, and be merry. A kind of hedonism that doesn't have any compassion with any reach to it. The children, Callahan is saying, might, and I'm not following Callahan now, but I think of Camus' novel, The Plague, and the last scene in that novel, the good Dr. Roux, after he has been through the campaign of fighting day after day, week in, week out, month after month, the plague, and has seen all of the repulsive behavior of people in response to those conditions and that situation, still says on the last page that he finds more in people to admire than to despise. What Callahan is asking, in effect, is does lifeboat ethics have space for the children of its practitioners to find in their parents more to admire than to despise? If viewed from this perspective of the moral legacy of lifeboat ethics, one has to ask about Hardin's last line of his essay, where he said, posterity will be satisfied with nothing less than the practice of lifeboat ethics. Okay, I think I'll just close here. A few more remarks, maybe we get to them in conversation if that's appropriate. Close here with these proposals of triage and lifeboat ethics and some of the responses to them. This is a part of an answer on the part of some people to the question, what do we do as a nation about the world food crisis? That is, my food ethics and triage are advanced as policy proposals, as the basis for legislation. It's a tough question, and while I find the policies proposed unthinkable and repulsive, the hard questions are there. That is to say, if you say something like, do your damnedest to feed the poor no matter what the long-term consequences of that might be. That is, no restrictions on eligibility, like a country having to, as some of the legislation that I mentioned, a country having to initiate a population control program by such and such a date, or they will no longer be recipient of food aid. That's one of the things that's popular in the legislation proposed now. If you say something like, there should be no qualifications on food aid, it should be sheer human need, that should be the only determinant, then you have to answer Hardin's contention that food only feeds the next famine wherever population is out of control. All I'm trying to say is that I think these are tough questions, and one can't respond to triage and life with ethics proposals simply as unthinkable and then sort of put them aside. Vern, you're about to say something.
Well, I just would like to know, I'm confused. I thought for a while you were agreeing with Callahan, and I just want to know what you think.
Yeah. I can give you the broad, I agree with Callahan about the appeal, and with the Club of Rome people about the appeal of lifeboat and triage ethics, namely that there will be the strongest pressures in our direction to attach those kind of ethics to our ethics of affluence. I think that two things. One, if we continue to live according to the patterns which now characterize the way we live, we will, in effect, be assuring the arrival of triage conditions. I do not think those are the conditions at present. That means what we ought to do is not embrace either triage or lifeboat ethics, but do all we can to make those changes which are necessary so as not to allow those conditions to arrive. An article that's over in the library now says it better than I can, an article by Alan Berg.
No, I don't want another article. I don't know what you think.
Well, the essence of that article is the same.
Well, I'd like to hear you say it.
But your next question is the one that I have the problems with, Vern. When you start asking, okay, what concretely does that mean? And I can tell you what concretely that means in general about reduction of consumption, about conservation of energy, about a different kind of technology needed, about all kinds of things, that still isn't a satisfying answer. I mean, I just bump up against all kinds of frustration when I'm asked what should we do in terms of specific policies, and more frustration at the point of having decided the policy direction, more frustration at the point of how do you get those things implemented? How do you change the values of a whole nation?
Well, do I hear you then advocating something similar to Al when he advocates moratorium and conservation? Hear you advocating change in lifestyle, change in ethos?
My dream would be the move toward what is called equilibrium economy, no growth economy, which says that the total amount of energy used, food consumed, will not exceed such and such an amount. Now you can have redistribution of all kinds of that, and that's part of that economy. So that the poor, now poor, so that you close the gap between rich and poor, but you have to do it by reducing the consumption of the well-off, of energy, of food, of resources. You know, that's the general outline, but that's not the tough question. The tough question is how you implement the changes that you see that are necessary.
You're speaking out governmentally, necessarily?
I'm speaking about a whole range of things. I can't see it happening apart from legislation, because apart from coercion. At this point, I agree with Hardin. Democracy at its very best is mutual coercion, mutually agreed upon. And I can't see it apart from a factor of coercion. That means legislation. That means the force of law. On the other hand, I can't see it happening apart from a whole lot of people making some voluntary moves as well. There, the dream is the dream of Martin Buber, who says that in times of great transition, and I think that characterizes our time, there is a desperate need for what Buber calls paradigmatic community. Somebody showing that something else can be done and embodying that in some kind of model, working out the nuts and bolts of a different way of living. I don't think that will happen by legislation. That will happen by some people. The dream is something that the church has a part in of doing that. So it's a combination. I don't know. Let's get everybody in on this. I mean, I'm glad to sort of spill and tell you what I think, but far more questions. I can give you an example of a small effort, and that's what it is. We are talking now and working on a proposal and going to begin effecting that proposal this summer. Something that you might describe as urban communalism, so that those of us who live within walking distance of each other in this particular neighborhood in D.C., Mount Pleasant, have agreed not only to buy in common and then use, in this case, our basement as a warehouse, but to buy in accord with what we see are needed diet changes, which is basically going to cereal from meat. We are also trying to cut down consumption by sharing goods. For example, 10 families don't need 8 lawnmowers. They need 1 lawnmower, at most 2 lawnmowers. Unless you're a waffle freak, you don't need a waffle iron in your house. 1 waffle iron, you know, within walking distance of you would be all right. An enormous amount of stuff is just duplicated in our homes that we don't need. Washer and dryer, you know. So we're going through that sort of sharing of those kinds of things. Skills is another thing. You barter skills. You do this and someone else does that. Tiny, tiny effort. But the principle there is a reduction of consumption and a change of diet. I know the problems that immediately come up. And one reason I was interested in listening to Al Pitcher yesterday talking about conservation of energy and listening to the response of the fellow who I take it was an executive of Shell Oil the overtones of the problems for employment that come with the conservation kind of program in energy rather than a growth program. At that point, we desperately need a new kind of technology which is labor intensive, which employs more people by using people as energy. You burn calories instead of oil. That's bicycles instead of cars. And there are lots of people doing some very exciting things in this different kind of technology. The technology we have now attempts to do its best to eliminate human labor and toil. Lots of it for good reasons, especially the way we organize it, assembly line kind of fashion. That is toil. What I'm saying is that you can go the route of energy conservation and increase jobs if you use the right kind of technology rather than decrease them. I've strayed, Vern, from where you were pushing.
I understand, is it Stanley Moneyham, the World Vision?
I don't know.
Has come out with, or is coming out with a book on world hunger. In fact, around the country now this summer, World Vision has got a 5-hour program, timeshare on TV, about the issue. I don't know if you're aware of anything.
I didn't know about that. I know about a flurry of activity. In fact, I know people who are already worrying about the world hunger being responded to as another kind of fad cause of an enormous play in the media that will get everybody fasting a day a week and sending their money to relief organizations, and that will happen for a while and then it'll be all over. Which isn't to say we ought not to have more conscientization about the whole matter. I don't mean to imply that. I do think on some of the responses to it, though, like the fasting, that you have, well, the fasting among us is important as a symbolic gesture, is important as the beginnings of what I think is needed as a new asceticism. We've got a whole ascetic tradition in the Christian church that desperately needs to be brought to the fore again. Fasting might be the beginning of a new asceticism with respect to food and energy, but it doesn't mean much in terms of translating any of the food not eaten into food for others, short of making some systemic structural changes in the way in which nations and corporations, multinational corporations, operate, behave in the world. So fasting is only the beginning of a solution if it leads to the structural changes. I worry about fasting as I see it occurring in the churches around the country as another in a long trail of responses in American church life that adds up to a response of piety to a systemic problem. And that response of piety to a systemic problem is a non-solution. Doesn't mean don't fast, it means it's the beginning of something else. It can be a discipline for somebody engaged in more than that. There are a lot of people, I didn't know about the World Vision, I know about some big campaigns that the National Council of Churches, all the major denominations are undertaking.
Don't you think we should talk a bit more about the structural changes you just mentioned?
Yeah,
we've been talking about supply side now all along.
Yeah.
And already you mentioned that market and pricing might be the major problem, I think it'd be there. But is that your quote, or is that someone else? You were saying that the market...
It's a supply and distribution problem rather than a production...
Right.
Production problem.
What sort of things are you talking about there? Or changes that should be...
Well, the World Food Conference did come up with some structural changes proposed and some new, quote, institutions with a kind of World Food Bank and reserve.
Well, what are you going to do about the purchasing power in those developed countries?
Yeah.
I mean, if there isn't any purchasing power, what are you going to say to the market prices?
The proposal of Kissinger that I think is interesting and significant is to put a floor on prices and a ceiling on prices so that countries receive a minimum for this grid, a minimum price for that grid, and also a ceiling that the price cannot go above that. That answers your question in part, in that it says that it will probably benefit those that are less well off now, because by and large the poor nations supply raw materials and are asked to buy in return heavy technology, the finished product. If you up the price on raw materials, and that is going to the more well off nations, the scheme there is that it puts more purchasing power in the hands of the present poorer nations. The Club of Rome, Mankind at the Turning Point, has something a little bit different in mind. And they approach it from the side of the redistribution of power, and what they're pushing is a kind of regionalization, so that in different areas you have a coalition of countries in a particular region that operate as a power block, a little bit like the OPEC countries on oil. And their scheme is something like this. Venezuela, which has some money now because of oil prices, will help its neighboring nations in Latin America to become more viable as political entities in the world and have some sort of competing power on that basis. And it's been interesting. Venezuela has upped its foreign aid to Latin American countries. Nigeria would be a leader in a regionalization scheme for Central and Southern Africa. I need to know much more about the specific policies.